I just casually looked towards the canal, and I saw what I thought was a mannequin.
August 2nd, 1998, a brilliant young scientist is found dead near the campus of Georgetown University. The gruesome murder shocked D.C., but she wasn't the killer's only victim.
He jumped into the door with a blanket.
Unknown Subject, Season 3 of WTOP's American Nightmare podcast series, follows one man's gruesome 9-year crime spree and detectives' never-ending pursuit to find him. I'm Paul Wagner, host of WTOP's American Nightmare podcast series, available October 4th on all podcast platforms.
Previously on 22 Hours, an American Nightmare.
Breaking news on WTOP.
Weeping erupts in the courtroom after Darren Wint is found guilty on all 20 counts in the D.C. mansion murders.
The core of it is what happened in the house, and he admitted he was in the house, and his hair was up on the bed upstairs, and his DNA is on the pizza, which was upstairs.
We're humans. We want to know what happened. We don't have an eyewitness of what happened behind those doors beyond Darren Wint.
I didn't realize how emotionally brutalized I would feel after.
It is being called a major crime scene as homicide investigators examine a house that caught fire in Northwest D.C.
The room is a crime scene.
They found 4 people, including a child, dead inside on the second floor.
Right now, it does not appear that this was just a random crime.
I said, but what happened? They said, we don't know. They killed the whole family.
Police have said they believe more than one person is responsible for the crime.
A wide-reaching manhunt for Darren Wint, stretching all the way to New York City.
We had the DNA on a piece of crust. How did his DNA get into that house?
Got a package that I'm going to need you to bring down to me.
To do what he did to 4 people, including a 10-year-old boy, is just beyond words.
They were brutalized, and we saw the evidence of that.
The jury has just reached a verdict in the murder trial of Darren Wint.
He was going to strike the American dream just by committing murder and mayhem.
This is 22 Hours, an American Nightmare.
It's kind of hard to believe that it's sentencing day. It's snowing outside. Walking up to D.C. Superior Court, a very different scene than when we were here in October for the verdict, and it was just gorgeous out. It's cold, and people are bundled up and trying to get inside as quickly as they can. The rest of the country has like a polar vortex right now, and I guess we're starting to feel it as well.
Before Darren Wint's sentencing, we knew prosecutors were asking for the harshest possible punishment. D.C. does not have the death penalty. So instead, prosecutors were asking for 4 consecutive counts of life in prison without the possibility of parole. 1 count for each of the victims.
I kind of wonder how Darren Wint is feeling right now. How can't you? I mean, he faces 4 life sentences. And he's going to have to hear from all of these family members. Forget Wint. How is the family feeling? It's got to be closure. Anyway, kind of the end of a very long saga here. We'll see how it goes.
In the days before his sentencing, we learned a lot more about Darren Wint than we'd ever known before, about his history of violence, and what he told his family and other inmates about those 2 horrible days in May 2015. Those details didn't come into the trial for good reason. The judge didn't want the jury to hold his previous offenses against Darren when deciding his case. Keeping prior offenses out of the courtroom is not unique to this case. The details of his background came in a memo from prosecutors to the judge, asking her to give Darren the harshest sentence possible in the District of Columbia. We've said his name probably 1,000 times throughout this podcast, but even with this new information about his past, in a lot of ways, Darren Wint was still a cipher. We saw him every day in the courtroom. We knew the horrific crimes on Woodland Drive that he was convicted of. We heard from several of his family members who testified at trial. We even heard from Darren when he took the stand, but he didn't spend a lot of time talking about anything except May 13th and 14th of 2015. It seems as if we're just still guessing at who he really is. Take his name. It may seem like a small detail, but there's even mystery around that. In the paperwork filed in this case, prosecutors always spelled Darren's name with two R's, D-A-R-R-O-N. However, in the defense's paperwork and motions, they always spelled it with one R. When D.C. police booked Darren, they used one R. So, which is the right way? We don't know. Even Vanessa, the person who probably knew Darren best in the spring of 2015, didn't know him as Darren. They'd been dating long distance for 2 years. She'd agreed to marry him, but she called him by his middle name, Dylan. On Facebook, he spelled it Dillian, like million with a D.
Dear Mr. Wendt, we are reporters with WTOP Radio in Washington, D.C. We covered your trial last fall in D.C. Superior Court, and we're now working on a podcast about the case and the trial.
Using one R, we wrote Darren a letter in jail before his sentencing.
We wanted to reach out to you directly to ask for an interview for this project. One of the pieces of the story that we didn't hear as much about during the trial was, who is Darren Wendt? We've seen a lot in other media reports about your background and your family, but we have been unable to confirm a lot of it.
He never responded. Beyond the obvious questions, we also wanted to know, what kind of person could commit these horrible crimes?
Well, in my case, as a former FBI criminal profiler, I have learned that you should never think that you've seen the depth of human behavior, the worst of human behavior, because anytime you do, something like this case comes along and, you know, you have to set the bar lower once again.
That's Clint Van Zandt. He retired from the FBI after 25 years, where he supervised the Behavioral Science Unit. Clint is an expert on crime and human behavior, and he's followed Darren's case since 2015. Jack spoke with him over the phone.
When this case first hit the news, unfortunately, I started thinking like I did on my last job, which is you take human behavior and you kind of put it in a bell curve. And you say, okay, this, based upon the facts of this case that we know, this is the individual or the type of individuals that are going to be the likely offenders. When I heard that there were four victims, it made me start to consider, is this a one-person crime or is this a two-individual crime?
Clint said the kind of extreme violence like we saw in this case is more commonly connected to crimes with multiple perpetrators. There is a profile for this type of home invasion killing because what happened to the Savopoulos family and Vera Figueroa has happened before. In 1959, four members of the Clutter family were killed in a small farming community in Kansas. Their murders were detailed in the book In Cold Blood, written by Truman Capote. In that case, and in many others since, more than one person was involved.
Brutal, torturing type of home invasions many times have had more than one person involved. So then the question that begs is, okay, if it's two, what is the relationship between the two individuals? Obviously, you know, at least one, if not two, just total sociopaths, psychopaths, because of the antisocial behavior, then where would individuals like this, you know, they would meet in jail, they would meet in prison. This would not be the first crime that an individual like this has committed. In essence, there's going to be a criminal history of this person of assaultive behavior, of violent behavior, of explosive behavior. This is going to be someone who has enjoyed hurting people in the past. And this is probably the apex of this antisocial behavior that this person or persons have likely committed. You know, if you can get into a residence in a home invasion, if you can threaten one of the individuals, the husband, the wife, the child, if you can get in a position where you can threaten the life of that person with a knife, with a gun, with some other type of weapon, then it's conceivable that you can take control over the entire household. Many times they'll have one victim tie the other victim or tape the other victim up. So it's a stretch to say that one person did it, but when you look at the background of the subject in this case, he likely was fully capable of doing something like this himself.
From the online court records, we knew Darren had several brushes with the law in his 20s, but those hadn't come up at all during his trial. However, after he was convicted, all of Darren Wendt's past was fair game. and it was detailed in Laura Bach's sentencing memo to the judge. Using those records, here's what we now know about Darren's past and the offenses that Clint Van Zandt said made him capable of carrying out the murders on his own. In 2000, when Darren moved from Guyana to Maryland, he first considered a career that likely would have taken him on a very different path in life. Then, 19 years old, he enlisted in the Marines. But he didn't make it far. He shipped out for basic training at Parris Island, South Carolina, in 2001. It was just a few months before 9/11. But just 2 months later, he was discharged. Marine Corps personnel records don't list a reason. In May 2003, when he was back in Maryland, Darren found work as a welder at American Iron Works, Savvasopoulos' company. He learned the detailed and skilled work of welding from his stepfather back in Guyana. And by all accounts, Darren was good at his job. But 2 years later, in 2005, Darren was fired from American Iron Works for missing work. At least, that's what the company records initially presented as evidence during his trial indicated. But later, prosecutors revealed to the judge, out of earshot of the jury, there had been a mix-up. They'd failed to turn over additional paperwork to the defense, which noted another reason why Darren was fired. It said he'd pulled a knife on a coworker. In the end, that detail, just like most of Darren's criminal record, was left out of his murder trial. Darren's criminal history began just a few months after he was fired from American Iron Works. And it began at home, when he was living with his dad. A few days before Thanksgiving that year, 2005, police were called to the house in Lanham, Maryland, for some kind of altercation. Darren's dad, Dennis, went to the courts to get a protective order against his son. He said Darren had threatened him, his wife, and Darren's younger half-sister, who was then only 8 or 9 years old. He said that standing in front of his house, Darren told him that he needed to be on the lookout for him, and that the police officers who had just responded to the house should have patted him down. They would have found what he had under his clothing. Then Darren told his dad he was going to find out who he really is. By the following year, in October 2006, Darren had moved out of his dad's house and was renting an apartment. Darren got into an argument with his landlord after he tried to park a car with broken windows and no tags in the shared driveway. The landlord said he was afraid the car was stolen and called police. Court records say that Darren threatened his landlord and the man's family, saying he would drop them one by one. The landlord filed for a protective order against Darren. Then Darren packed up and moved to Oswego, New York. It was there Darren's threats turned into actions. In December 2006, Darren was arrested for attacking a man named Michael Babcock. ABC's 2020 interviewed Michael Babcock back in 2015 about the incident.
It's in this port city, nestled along Lake Ontario, where Michael Babcock is about to see Wint's temper up close. We brought him back to the scene of his cousin's house, where Babcock was trying to get Wint to leave after his cousin complained. After an altercation, Wint suddenly attacked.
Darren had come out and was windmilling with the knives, and I went up at that and blocked, and that's where he stabbed me in the wrist.
Wint was arrested and ordered to stay away from Babcock. But while waiting for trial, he suddenly ambushed Babcock a second time on this bridge. Babcock was rushed to the emergency room, where he was told he was lucky to be alive.
When Darren stabbed me in the neck, if it would have been a little bit lower, the doctors told me that I would have died before I made it to the first hospital.
Prosecutors said Darren initially lied to police, claiming he never had a knife and he never stabbed anyone. In fact, he said someone else had the knife and he had been attacked. Darren ultimately pleaded guilty to third-degree assault and served a little less than 3 months in jail. Shortly after he was released, Darren was arrested again for stabbing another man. Again, he lied to police and claimed he was actually the victim, that two men had jumped him. At one point, Darren suggested to police that maybe the man had fallen on his own knife. In the end, he pleaded guilty to third-degree assault. A few years later, in 2010, Darren was back in Maryland, and prosecutors said his explosive rage and violent threats continued to escalate. According to the records, Darren got into a fight with his then-girlfriend. She was able to calm him down and take him home, But about an hour later, he called her up and threatened to kill her and her two-year-old daughter. The woman was so disturbed, she called 911. Police officers were at her house when Darren called back, still enraged. She put the phone on speaker, and officers heard him continue to threaten her, saying he was good with a knife and could kill them easily. A few hours later, he texted her to go look at her car. When she did, she discovered he'd busted out the windshield. Darren eventually pleaded guilty to malicious destruction of property. In the sentencing memo to the judge, lead prosecutor Laura Bach mentioned these past offenses and said there were common themes in Darren's criminal history. He has a quick temper. He holds a grudge. And he uses or threatens to use knives. And, she said, the court records don't even tell the full story. She said her office had interviewed former co-workers and family members who said Darren had an extremely short fuse, often overreacting, pulling out knives, and threatening to stab people in response to minor incidents. Something else we noticed throughout his criminal history, after losing his temper, Darren would often claim he was the victim.
I worked with Darren at a company called Metal Fab, and we worked together. I'd been there for many years prior to Darren coming on board. My boss, of course, hired him. He had welding experience.
This is Melissa. She told Jack over the phone that she didn't want us to use her last name.
When I first met him, he seemed like, you know, he was kind of, you know, like every new employee, kind of friendly to everybody.
Metal Fab was a metal fabrication shop in Hyattsville, Maryland. It's no longer open. Darren got a job there as a welder after he was fired from American Iron Works. It was a relatively small shop. Only about 15 people worked there. And Melissa said they were close-knit, almost like family. She said the guys would often stay late to work on side projects with scrap metal, making bookcases or picture frames to give as gifts to their wives or girlfriends. And Darren was no exception.
But, you know, he did keep to himself the majority because he was, he was new.
Did you ever see him, you know, get angry at people or have a temper or anything like that?
That's my knowledge, no. I mean, him and I had a, that was there at the end when, you know, Howard was in the hospital.
In July 2011, she said she saw a different side of Darren. The owner of the business, a man named Howard, was sick in the hospital, and he'd asked Melissa to close up shop at the end of the day.
You know, I had to go because I had kids. The guys wanted to stay late, and, you know, I was being responsible for everything, and I was like, no, can't stay late tonight because Howard asked me to close up. You know, and he kind of got real angry about that, and I'm like, well, I'm just doing as I'm told, and he was trying to call Howard. I'm like, Howard's in the hospital, you know. You could try to call him, but he's not going to answer your phone call.
This is where things get strange.
Yeah, you could tell he was losing his temper, but it wasn't like he was yelling or screaming or anything like that. He was annoyed more so than anything.
The situation was eventually diffused, and Melissa said she really didn't think anything of it. She closed up the shop like she was told. This incident wasn't cited in the prosecution's memo, but we did find it in court files. Despite the fact that Melissa thought it was a forgettable workplace dispute, Darren took it a step further. He went to police to file assault charges against her.
What all that was about, I have no clue. I never heard from the police officers, so when you told me that, that was the first I've ever heard of it.
His version of events is a little bit different. He said he wanted to leave early, and he was calling the boss to see if he could leave work early when he said you snatched the phone out of his hand, became very angry, and proceeded to punch him in the face repeatedly.
I did?
That's what he said.
Did I punch him?
Yeah.
No, there was other witnesses there who saw it too. So
that never happened.
No, that never happened, sir. Not at all.
A few weeks after Darren filed the charges, local prosecutors dropped the case. It's likely why Melissa never knew Darren went to the police reporting she attacked him. Then later, and totally unrelated to the phone incident,
Howard ended up letting him go. I don't know the circumstances of that, though. I do not recall all that, sir.
4 years after that, Darren was arrested for the murders on Woodland Drive.
Do you remember your reaction?
Yeah, actually, kind of shocked, really.
By May 2015, Metal Fab had closed down. But Melissa said she stayed close with several of the guys she used to work with.
You know, when we all got together and, you know, somebody brought it up. But, you know, we normally, because we have all worked together for so long, you know, we're kind of like, you know, distant family, you know. I mean, we couldn't believe it. None of us could really believe it because we didn't see that side.
She said, even though Darren worked at Metal Fab for several years, he always kind of seemed like the new guy.
You know, no one knew what was really going on because no one really knew his private life like that. I mean, we knew of what he allowed us to know.
Darren had several years of what seemed like constant brushes with the law. But worth noting is in the 4 years before the murders, there is nothing in his criminal history. He was unemployed for the majority of that time, and it appears, at least, he was keeping his nose clean. That is, of course, until May 2015, when he committed one of the most horrific crimes Washington, D.C. has ever known. After the trial ended, we pored through the spreadsheets of Darren's search history on his phone. We got a copy from prosecutors after the trial. The search history goes back to October 2014, 8 months before the murders. As you know, there were no searches on Darren's phone for the Savopoulos' address or their name. Nothing to indicate that he planned the home invasion or knew where his former boss lived. But there were those incriminating searches after the murders, which were brought up during the trial, like how to beat a lie detector and hide out cities for fugitives. But in those spreadsheets, we spotted a search that wasn't mentioned at the trial, which seemed to indicate Darren knew the Savopoulos' name before the victims were publicly identified. That search for the words "savage vocalist die," which we told you about a few episodes back. We kept looking through these documents for any sign, any clue, anything that might reveal more about Darren. Clint Van Zandt said, "We'll likely never know more. Even people close to him probably never knew the real Darren."
This is a person who just makes up stories as he goes, and he looks you right in the eye, and he lies to you. But realize, this is a person who has lied their entire life. Their whole life has been somewhat of a fantasy, and that anything they did that society would look down upon, they would shrug their shoulders, they would laugh, they would make up a story to cover it, and they would tell a new story again, and they would never feel any remorse for that type of behavior. And of course, 99% of society says, we don't understand that, but this individual understands it very well. That's what he does, and he will continue to do it till he's dead. He's not going to change. He's not going to get better. He's not going to be reformed.
You already know that Darren's cell phone history from the months before the murders is filled with searches for luxury cars. Audis, BMWs, Maseratis, Corvettes, and Porsches. There were also a lot of searches for celebrities, even the show Cribs, where music stars and actors show off their lavish homes. It seemed like Darren hungered not just for a better life, but for a life of ultimate luxury.
Crimes like this can develop sometimes. It can begin simply as an act of robbery, burglary, a way to get money. But again, once you get in, that can change. A simple burglary can become a murder. And the family may have represented everything that he never achieved. I mean, this is someone who was playing the lottery, thinking he was going to win the lottery.
We know from family members who testified that Darren played the lottery constantly. Godfrey, his sister's boyfriend, had given him an old laptop that Darren used to calculate numbers.
In this case of this assailant, did he go in for money? Yeah, I think he went in for money. But then everything evil, I think, that was within this person rose up when he saw the chance that this is what I should be in life. I should have a house. I should have a home. I should have money. I should have cars. Society has denied me, and you people are representative of that society that has denied me this, and I'm going to punish you. And he punished them without any remorse whatsoever for what he thought he missed in life.
Darren went from having no money to being flush with cash, and he had no trouble spending it. Just a few weeks before, his sisters back in Guyana had been sending him money to support him. When Darren went to visit Vanessa in New York in May 2015, he was suddenly the provider. He took her shopping, bought her groceries, took her out to dinner, and paid her rent. We wonder if it boosted his ego, gave him a power he never had, to be a man with means.
I mean, this is probably more money than he's ever held in his hand. To him, it was like hitting the lottery, but unfortunately, people had to die for him to win. But, you know, his expectation of success was on an hourly, a daily basis. I mean, you know, most of us say, well, you know, go through high school, go through college, get a good job, you know, maybe go to graduate school, eventually, you know, you're going to strike the American dream. He was going to strike the American dream just by committing murder and mayhem.
One final thing about Darren's search history, it ends abruptly about a week before the murders, or at least the spreadsheet detailing his searches end there. The last listed searches are from Friday, May 8th, 5 days before the Savopoulos family and Vera Figueroa were taken hostage. Again, these are just cell phone searches, but what someone looks up on their phone seems like a window into their state of mind, or at least into what they're thinking about. How many times a day do you think of something and then immediately go to your phone to look it up? So what were those final things Darren searched for? Along with queries for cars, movies, and music, two searches seem to stick out. Late night on May 8th, 2015, Darren searched for video of Marines boot camp in 2002. And then a few minutes later, video of Marines in 2002, Darren. Darren had enlisted in the Marines, although it was in 2001, so the date is off. Maybe he misremembered? But beyond that, what was going through his mind? Was he thinking about a past life? The path not taken? Remember, by this point in May 2015, Darren had been out of work for a few years. He'd racked up a handful of assault convictions. He had an expired green card. He'd been couch surfing without a permanent place to stay, and he'd just been given 30 days' notice to leave his dad's house. When he was doing those searches, was he wondering how his life might have turned out differently? During the trial, prosecutor Laura Bach accused Darren of fabricating his testimony. She said in the years before he went to trial, Darren had been rehearsing his story and writing a timeline to account for all the government's evidence, changing it and tweaking it as he learned what the government had against him, all so he could make his story fit perfectly. After Darren Wint was convicted, we learned more details about the shifting stories Darren first told family and loved ones about his whereabouts on May 13th and 14th of 2015. In their sentencing memo, prosecutors laid out for the first time what Vanessa, Darren's fiancée, said he told her on the night they were lying in bed, when his face flashed on the news. According to prosecutors, Darren told Vanessa he went to 3201 Woodland Drive just by chance on May 12th, the day before the family was taken hostage, and he saw his old boss, Sava Savopoulos. He said Sava agreed to let him wash the family cars, and that if he did a good job, he was to come back the following day to get paid. Darren said when he went back to the house the next day, no one was home, so he walked around into the garage, which was open, and he saw some pizza on the floor. So he took a bite, but it was too cold, so he didn't finish it. Then, he said, he left. At the point when he was telling this to Vanessa, Darren only knew from news reports that investigators had found his DNA on the pizza crust. But later, investigators also found his DNA on the construction vest in the Porsche and on the kitchen knife in the basement, as well as two tiny strands of hair that matched his profile. He also didn't know about the grand jury testimony of the Australian ambassador's grounds workers, taken shortly after the murders, who said the garage door wasn't already open the day of the fire. Rather, it opened as Darren approached and then closed behind him. There was another part of the story that Darren told Vanessa that doesn't make sense. He told her he went to the house during the day on May 13th, but the pizza wasn't ordered until after 9 that night. So prosecutors pointed out in their memo to the judge, Darren moved on to another version of his story. They say at one point Darren gave a vague alibi that he was in Maryland at the time of the murders and that his DNA must have been in the house because he used to work for Sava Savopoulos and he'd gone to the home to visit him and ask for a job. Darren claimed that when he left, Sava was still alive and that he had so much money because he won $5,000 a week playing the lottery. But none of Darren's family members ever came forward to offer an alibi for Darren during the time of the murders. And again, this version of events didn't explain how Darren's DNA wound up on the construction vest in the burned-out Porsche. On top of that, prosecutors pulled lottery results showing Darren never won the lottery, and they turned them over to Darren's lawyers in the discovery process. Prosecutors said Darren was once again backed into a corner, and so he changed his story. Laura Bach said to the judge, as each falsehood was debunked, Darren Wint came up with a new theory. He was rehearsing. Laura Bach said, depending on who he was talking to, his story changed. She argued Darren kept changing his story to fit with all the new evidence he was learning, but his options were running out. So he falsely accused his brothers. When Darren testified, he said his brothers had set him up, that Darrell lured him to the house on Woodland Drive, a place he said he'd never been to and didn't know belonged to his former boss, and that it was Darrell who got him to leave his DNA on the pizza crust and then left him to take the fall. But he'd never said that before. After Darren was arrested, he didn't claim Darrell set him up. In their sentencing memo, prosecutors pointed to jailhouse phone calls that Darren made to his family members after his arrest. In a phone call with one of his sisters back in Guyana, Darren didn't say anything about Darrell setting him up for murder. He accused Darrell of telling on him. And the timing of that conversation is worth noting. August 2015, just a few weeks after Darren may have learned Darrell worked with law enforcement. It was during one of the first preliminary hearings in Darren's case when Detective Jeff Owens testified he'd been in contact with Darrell Wint on the night they were swarmed by U.S. Marshals. And there was more. Darren spent a lot of time in the D.C. jail with different cellmates, awaiting trial. And it turns out, investigators were talking to those men. Now, a quick note about jailhouse informants. Prosecutors are often loath to bring their statements into a trial because there are clear credibility issues. It's easily boiled down to one inmate's word against another. There's a rule of thumb. If you can win the case without having to use the statements from jailhouse informants, do it. Laura Bach didn't bring it into trial, but she decided to use some of those statements in her sentencing memo to the judge, in asking Darren to receive the most severe sentence possible. She said, Darren told some inmates his brother or people from the islands set him up. But to others, Darren seemed to brag about the crime. Prosecutors said he reveled in his power over the victims. To one inmate, Darren complained Sava Savopoulos was weak, that he couldn't believe someone with all that money would be so weak as to beg Darren to spare his family's life, and that he couldn't believe Sava had raised such a weak son who cried for his mother as Darren killed him. Again, these stomach-churning details come from prosecutors. As far as we can tell, the defense never answered these charges. There's no record of the defense filing its own sentencing memo, in which Judy Pipe and Jeff Stein would have laid out a more complete picture of Darren than that of a convicted killer, with notes from his background, his childhood, and prior good acts. Throughout this podcast, we've provided you with both the prosecution and the defense's take on evidence and testimony, but we don't have the defense's response to any of the prosecution's points in their sentencing memo to the judge. The fact that we didn't find a record of the defense's memo could mean that it was filed under seal, but we can't know for certain. But it means the explosive charges from prosecutors, details that never made it into the trial, were just left out there hanging, unchallenged. Just a few days after prosecutors laid out the sentences they believe Darren Wint deserved, we all filed into the courtroom to learn the judge's decision. So much of Darren Wint's trial was about the evidence, the facts of this case. Other than the testimony of Amy's father, Jim Martin, no one else took the witness stand during the trial itself to share their memories of Sava, Amy, Philip, and Vera, or how they've struggled to cope in the years since their deaths. But that silence ended during Darren's sentencing. Multiple family members and close friends read their victim impact statements to the judge, describing their grief, their bittersweet memories, and how the crime has forever altered their lives. A woman who tutored the Savopoulos girls and who, at the time of the murders, was tutoring Philip, gave her statement. The woman said she had the most beautiful memories of Philip, how bright and creative he was, his sense of humor, his impeccable manners. She said even at 9 and 10 years old, he was a perfect gentleman. Whenever he was introduced to another one of her students, he would extend his hand to introduce himself and say, "Glad to meet you." Next came a statement from the Savopoulos' group of friends. They wrote, "Until the day Darren Wint stole them away, the Savopoulos family represented the American dream. Sava and Amy would go out of their way to check on friends in need, to extend a hand, to pitch in at every event." Their friends said they remember the day of the funeral, wanting to say their goodbyes to Amy, Sava, and Philip individually, but not knowing which casket belonged to which person. Then it was announced in court that Abigail Savopoulos, one of the two surviving Savopoulos children, would be reading her statement in court. It was the first and only day she set foot in courtroom 203. In her statement, Abigail described the moment she first learned something terrible had happened. Just like her younger sister, Katerina, Abigail was away at boarding school during the murders. Her mother, father, and brother were killed. Her childhood home torched, just a few days before her high school graduation and the day before her senior prom. Abigail was trying out different hairstyles with her roommate when she got the call. She heard her grandmother sobbing on the other end of the line, and then she heard the four words that changed her life. There was a fire. Abigail said to the court, "Rather than picking a dress to wear to my upcoming graduation, I was selecting caskets. While all my friends were on a school senior retreat, I was touring a graveyard and picking burial plots. While they enjoyed their first summer before college, I was figuring out how to write a check and pay my bills." Abigail said, "My parents were my best friends. I came to them in the good and the bad times. They were my biggest supporters and my strongest advocates. My parents loved each other more than any other couple I ever met. They taught me what true love looked like. They stood by each other no matter what. As much as they loved each other, they loved their children more. They believed in all of us and encouraging each of us to pursue our dreams." Of her father, Abigail said, "He was a person I would come to when I was struggling or had to make a difficult decision. His voice of reason still lingers in the back of my mind. He taught me the importance of reading every contract I sign, including the iTunes terms and conditions. He taught me how to write an essay correctly, train a dog, shoot a gun, throw a ball, and so much more. Above all, he showed me how a man should care for and support his family, and how vital a father's love is in the life of a child." Abigail remembered her mother as the most resilient and kind-hearted woman. There was nothing in the world that she loved more than her children and her family. "Even on my moodiest of days, I was always greeted by her loving voice saying, 'Good morning, sunshine.' She wrote me a letter every week I was away at boarding school, sometimes a few times a week, and called me almost every day. Many people that knew my mother have told me that I'm just like her. I see more and more of my mother in myself every day, and not a day goes by that I don't hear her voice in my head. For months after she died, I would stare at my phone, just waiting for her to call. Although I know that call will never come, sometimes I just stare at my phone, hoping and praying that it will ring, and I'll hear her say, "Hi, sunshine," just one more time. As a child, I grew up imagining my dream wedding, my mother helping me do my hair and makeup, my father walking me down the aisle, my brother as one of the groomsmen, my father smiling at me during the father-daughter dance. Abigail told the court she'd gotten engaged the summer before the trial to the man of her dreams, and her first thought was to call her mom to share the good news. She said, "It was at that moment that I realized my parents would not be there for what was supposed to be the happiest day of my life. Those things I dreamed of as a little girl would never happen. It's odd how you can feel so happy and in love, but simultaneously feel like there's a hole in your heart and life that will never be filled." Abigail's younger sister, Katerina, was not in the courtroom. But like her sister, she had prepared a statement. It was read aloud in the courtroom by a victim's advocate for the U.S. Attorney's Office. In her statement, Katerina shared her memories of their mother, father, little brother, and of Vera. "Philip, my baby brother, and I were working on reading Harry Potter. Every Sunday night, he would call and discuss what he had read. I miss waiting for my phone to ring to talk about the world of witchcraft and wizardry. He was smarter than me and my sister combined. We all knew that, loved it, and were so excited to see the man he would soon become. Thinking about my sweet, gentle brother being eternally 10 hurts like hell. Birthdays are no longer something to celebrate because he isn't with us anymore." Katerina made sure to take time to talk about Vera, calling her part of the family. "She wiped away my tears when I was bullied in school, cleaned out my cuts from the playground, taught me how to curl my hair for dances, and even how to use feminine hygiene products. It is painful to know that Vera will never see her kids or kiss her husband goodnight again." Katerina's letter also included a haunting description of her experience going back to the house on Woodland Drive for the first time after the fire. Katerina said she'd seen the footage of the billowing smoke and flames bursting through her bedroom window as firefighters tried to put out the fire. But, she said, there was no way to imagine what they would find behind those walls. We pushed our way through the doorway. I let out a long sigh as I stood in the dark, smoky living room, holding a flashlight, taking everything in. The piano I'd played for years was covered in plaster, a leg broken off. Each room we went through triggered flashbacks of different events as we combed through many sentimental objects like old report cards and notes from my parents to one another. I looked at my sister. We knew it was time to go upstairs. The wallpaper had been burned and smudged by the fire, and every surface had layers of dust, glass, and darkness. Still, some part of me held out hope that something, anything, would have survived the fire. Maybe a stuffed animal would be left in the corner of my room. I turned the corner to the door, like I had a million times before. But when I arrived, there was neither a door nor a wall. The room I once called my own was blackened and burned. She wrote, "That's when it hit her. It had been her bedroom where her brother's body was found. He had died on her bed. The fire had destroyed everything. The flames had stripped the walls down to the boards." Katerina said it looked as if the whole house was leaning into a black hole of destruction. She said the sight was so upsetting, she ran out of her room to her parents' bedroom down the hall that was untouched by the fire. She wrote, "I half expected them to be in their bed, Dad on the right, Mom on the left. But the bed was empty. The sheets were gone." Desperate for comfort and to feel connected again, Katerina opened a drawer in their closet where she knew her mother kept her scarves and her dad, his pocket handkerchiefs. The mix of their scents wafted over me. I quickly grabbed one of each and rubbed the silk scarf on my nose and chin. In that room, they were the only things that brought me close to my parents again. I pocketed the scarf and hanky and heard my name being called, signaling it was time to leave. Later that night, when Katerina reached for that comfort again, all she could smell on her mother's scarf was the smoke. I gagged. The scent it once had was gone. It was an extraordinarily well-written letter, heartfelt and emotional. But that wasn't the most remarkable thing about Katerina's statement in court. Toward the end of her letter, the focus shifted to the man convicted of killing her family. She wrote, "There was a time when hearing the name of the accused perpetrator would trigger immediate anger and fear. She said she'd suffered nightmares and panic attacks. She said she was afraid of dying herself and also living without her family. I still have moments, even days where I feel like I'm drowning. But the fear has changed." One night, Katerina said when she was up late with a bout of insomnia, she began to think, what was Darren's life like before all this? In her words, how did he end up not being able to see love? Only someone who's been deprived of love, someone who doesn't even recognize it when it's right in front of them, can take love away from others. Maybe if there was more love around us, a little more human decency, this wouldn't have happened. You can't fight fire with fire, and you shouldn't fight hate with hate. Take that vengeful passion and turn it into the water of love. Put out that fire. That's the only way you can begin to repair the damage. Katerina said she wasn't trying to justify what happened to her family. These are things we can never forget and will probably never understand. But we can forgive. Hating the people who hurt us will not right any wrongs. We should spend our time trying to forgive those who have wronged us rather than prolonging the pain. Although forgiving will never change what has happened, it makes me feel a bit less empty. It's a step towards recovery. Then, the letter addressed Darren directly. To Darren Wint, although I cannot be at the sentencing, I want you to know that I forgive you. I understand that many will disagree with me, even family members. However, in my heart, I believe it's what my parents, and especially what little Philip would have wanted. I truly hope you find peace and can have access to the services that you need to heal. There was a shared feeling in the courtroom of utter despair. It was the first time that we'd heard from the Savopoulos daughters, from Philip's big sisters, and it was absolutely heartbreaking. Just a few feet from where Abigail stood, where her tutor, her parents' friends, and her sister's letter were read aloud, Darren Wint sat wearing an orange jail jumpsuit. It was hard to tell if her words had any effect on him. He didn't seem to react. Then it was time for the attorneys to make their last appeal before the judge handed down Darren's sentence. Darren didn't make a statement himself, which is customary when a person plans to appeal their conviction. But his lawyer, Judy Pipe, stood up to make a few brief remarks. She said, "There was no argument at trial. What happened was horrific and unforgivable. Mr. Wint's position at trial was that he was an innocent man. That's his position here today." She said Darren was asking for mercy from the court, for the minimum sentences on the murder charges, decades in prison, but not a life sentence. When lead prosecutor Laura Bach spoke, she said only the maximum punishment was appropriate. "We can't undo what that man has done," she said. "We can't bring these people back. Laura Bach said she wanted the court to send a message. This was by far one of the most heinous crimes that's ever happened in Washington, D.C. She said anything less than life in prison would give Darren some small measure of hope. We're asking for a sentence that's on par with the sentence he imposed on his victims. We want the court to take away his hope. Then Judge Juliet McKenna did just that. It was her turn to speak. The judge called what the victims had been through incomprehensible suffering and denied Darren Wendt any opportunity for release or rehabilitation. She said, "It's only just that the sentence reflect the four lives taken." She sentenced Darren to four consecutive life terms plus 50 years. The 50 years was the combination of the time for the additional counts, 32 years for kidnapping, 8 years for first-degree burglary, 5.5 years for arson, 2 years for extortion, and 2 years for first-degree theft. The judge's sentence did send a message. There would be no time for good behavior, no parole. The sentence meant Darren would die behind bars. Outside the courtroom on that winter day, snow had started falling again. The two prosecutors, Laura Bach and Chris Bruckman, walked out of the doors of D.C. Superior Court and approached the gaggle of reporters. Laura Bach had finally agreed to take a few questions. The attorneys were flanked by other officials from the U.S. Attorney's Office and the D.C. Police Department, as well as the family members of the victims. Laura Bach started off talking about Sava, Amy, Philip, and Vera. Throughout this podcast, we've had our colleague Lauren Larson read the part of Laura Bach. But now, you'll hear Laura Bach in her own voice, responding to reporters' questions.
Could you just talk a little bit about what today means to the family?
Well, we can't bring them back, and I think that's what would make them whole. So hopefully this gives them a small measure of closure. Hopefully this is the end of this part, and it will allow them to continue to heal a little bit. But it's going to be a long journey. I think they focus a lot on Abigail and Katerina and trying to be there for them and trying to fill the role that Amy and Sava would have filled. And, you know, I don't want us to forget about Vera because I have to say what her family has experienced is very similar. She has two children in El Salvador. She has a daughter here, grandchildren here. And as I said, I don't think her husband has even begun to heal from all of this.
How is this murder different from so many other murders you've seen in the nation's capital?
You don't often see something this senseless. There was no reason for this. He got what he wanted. He got the money he could have just left. To do what he did to four people, including a 10-year-old boy, I think is just beyond words. I can't imagine what those parents were going through.
Just to echo the one question, you've tried a number of defendants. Mr. Wendt, what does he stack in that roster?
There's nothing. There's no remorse. There's no remorse in his mind. He thinks he's a victim in all of this somehow.
The snow was starting to pick up, and so she ended the brief press conference.
We really want to thank Judge McKenna for her sentence today. The jury reached the right verdict, but Judge McKenna, I think, really nailed it when she gave him the sentence that she did with the four consecutive terms of life without release. So we thank her for that. We thank the jury for their hard work. I can't imagine how hard it was for them. And hopefully this brings a little bit of closure to the families. One thing we would like to say is the families have very much respected the privacy you guys have shown and the respect. They still would ask that you continue to respect that as they try to heal. And I think that's everything.
On the day of the verdict, there was a frenetic sense of excitement that often comes with breaking news. On this day, there was just heaviness. A sadness the gray skies seemed to reflect. A sense of finality. It was truly all over. After the sentencing, Darren's stay at the D.C. jail came to an end as well. It was the most stable place he'd called home in a while. He'd lived there for 3 years, longer than he did with his brother Stefan, longer than he did with his sister Samantha. But in a way, he was being kicked out again. Washington, D.C. doesn't operate any of its own prisons. People convicted in D.C. courts and sentenced to prison carry out their sentences in federal facilities. In the 6 months since Darren learned his sentence, he spent time in four different federal penitentiaries, including one facility in Louisiana, cited as one of the most dangerous in the country. Earlier this summer, according to the Bureau of Prisons inmate tracking website, Darren was transferred to an administrative facility in Miami, and then a high-security federal prison in Central Florida. As prisoners first enter federal custody, some movement is normal. But Darren's moves seem unusual, according to Chris Zukas, a consultant who runs a website on resources for federal inmates and their families. Zukas told us he didn't have any special insight into Darren's case, but he said the series of moves over the course of several months could be a sign Darren is having a hard time adjusting to life in prison. He said many prisons are highly political, meaning the culture inside the prison walls is regulated by gangs. During the months that we spent working on this podcast, we tried to reach out to Darren's family multiple times. We called, and Stefan turned us down. We sent messages on Facebook, and his sister never responded. We reached out to family and friends to try and contact Darrell, to no avail. And we knocked on their doors and spoke with Darren's father, Dennis, who declined to talk with us. We didn't see any of Darren's family members during the trial either. They weren't in the courtroom. Because nearly everyone in his family, who lives in the area, was a potential prosecution witness, they were prohibited from watching the court proceedings in case they were called on to testify. But toward the end of putting this podcast together, we finally got a chance to speak with a close relative of Darren's. We showed up at her door, and she agreed to talk with us. She was gracious and open, but she didn't want to be recorded, and she didn't want us to identify her or her relationship to Darren. Still, knowing who we were and that we were working on this project, she kept talking to us and answered our questions. It was almost like she didn't want us to leave. It made us think of how lonely it all must be to have someone in your family accused of and then convicted of such horrible crimes. We got the sense that there weren't a lot of people she could talk to about this. She said she's been worried at times about losing her job when people find out who she's related to. She also told us something we didn't know, another piece of information that we hadn't heard before. Darren is a father. He has a teenage daughter. We asked how her and her family are doing, about the divisions between them caused by the crime and Darren's accusations of his brothers. She said she doesn't believe the full truth has come out. She said she still can't believe Darren is guilty. That's not the Darren she knows. And she says she believes, and these are her words, that what was in the darkness will be brought to the light. Darren Wint is appealing his conviction. Judy Pipe and Jeff Stein are no longer representing him. His case has been transferred to the Appeals Division at the D.C. Public Defender Service. In a previous episode, we told you about a major precedent-setting case that ensures defendants during a trial are able to argue the possibility that someone else is actually responsible for the crime. It was named for the D.C. man who successfully appealed his conviction, Reginald Winfield. A Winfield defense is the legal strategy that Judy Pipe, unsuccessfully, tried to use to defend Darren. The lawyer who represented Reginald Winfield back in the 90s, who argued his appeal and won Winfield a new trial, is still at the Public Defender Service. Her name is Samia Pham, and she's now taking on Darren's appeal. We understand the process of appealing his conviction could take the better part of a decade. As we did throughout the trial, we've continued to give the Savopoulos family space. They've made it clear they're not ready to talk to reporters, and it's not clear they'll ever be. The family's house on Woodland Drive, as we've mentioned earlier, was sold at a loss and then torn down about 2 years after the murders. The corner lot, secluded behind a massive chain-link fence and overgrown hedges, still lies empty. The property's back on the market. However, it's listed under a new address. No longer on Woodland Drive. It's on 32nd Street. The current owner had intended to build a new home on the lot and even had a house designed. But for some reason, the plans fell through and the property went back up for sale. Still, architectural renderings online showed the design for a massive, modern glass structure. It almost looks like a museum or an office building, not a house. Definitely not like the stately brick home that once stood there. The asking price for the empty lot is just under $3 million. I've covered crime and courts for years for WTOP and will continue to do so. The depravity and the mystery around this case has stuck with me. And the drama of the complicated trial was unlike any other I've covered. It's part of the reason we decided to do this podcast. We'll continue to follow this case and Darren's appeal process. We've told you that we've petitioned DC Superior Court to release the audio recordings from this trial, something it's never done before. If we are eventually able to share those tapes with you, we will. If we ever hear back from Darren Wint, or anyone else we've tried to reach for this podcast, and they're willing to talk with us, we'll let you know. So stay subscribed to this podcast. We'll release new information there if and when we get it. You can also sign up for email alerts at 22hourspodcast.com.
I just got off the metro at Judiciary Square. I'm going to cover another trial.
In the meantime, I'm already back to my day job.
Going to cover another case of a little girl who was shot and killed in her neighborhood, accidental victim of a gang shooting. And it should be an interesting status hearing as status hearings go. But can't help but think, you know, as we're wrapping up the podcast, it's just, you know, we spent so many weeks going to this metro station and covering the trial of Darren Wint, and now the wheels of justice continue to turn, if you will, in D.C.
Jack will also be at the courthouse. As we were working on the final episode of this podcast, he actually got a jury duty summons in the mail from D.C. Superior Court. He reports for duty the week after this episode comes out. As we come to the end of this story, we're reflecting back on this whole process. This was the first podcast Jack and I have ever done, and we learned a lot. We've been asked if we're doing another podcast or if there will be a second season. We don't really know. Truth be told, we struggled with whether we should even create this podcast. We didn't want to cause any more pain for the victims' families and friends. And throughout our process, we've kept that in mind. These are real people who've suffered in a way none of us can imagine. The murders of Vera Figueroa and the Savopoulos family were among the most heinous crimes ever committed in Washington, D.C. But after sitting through 6 weeks of the trial, there were still questions and details about this case that we thought were important to explore in a way that short soundbites and news reports couldn't fully accomplish. This podcast has allowed us to tell this story in as complete a way as it's ever been told. What happened, what didn't happen, who's responsible, and who's not. It has allowed us to shed light on the type of person who would commit such a terrible crime and explain how the justice system works. Certainly, putting this podcast together gave us greater insight into the timeline, those 22 hours the victims were held. If you tally up all the time that you've spent listening to this podcast, over 12 episodes, it's only about half the time Sava, Amy, Philip, and Vera were held inside that house. It's hard to come to grips with the fact that we'll probably never know everything that happened during that time. We probably won't know what Darren's intentions were when he showed up at Woodland Drive. Was it all just about the money? Was there a plan for the crime, or did it escalate at some point? And yes, that question that's so easy to speculate about, but so hard to answer definitively in the absence of evidence. Did he have help? It's a question the jury couldn't come to an agreement on, and they didn't have to. Their job was to decide if Darren committed these crimes, and they did. The prosecution's case was that Darren was desperate for money and carried out these crimes alone, and they were able to prove their case to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. But that phrase, beyond a reasonable doubt, that's a legal term. As human beings, we don't want any room for doubt. We want answers. There were times during this case when we became familiar with what you might call unreasonable doubt. Unreasonable because we wanted all the answers, and we know we won't get them. Retired FBI profiler Clint Van Zandt says, sometimes, years later, convicted killers do divulge more about their crimes.
They'll start to bargain for a different prison, a different location, a different cell. So there may be, if he sees some good for himself in the future, and that he could use some semblance of the truth as a chip in this terrible poker game that he would like to play, maybe then we would hear something. But, I mean, we're not going to, this is not the individual who's going to, you're going to get the deathbed confession and say, okay, you know, I have to tell you the truth. This is who did it with me, and this is how it happened. Now, there's nothing in him that would ever see that as his reality.
In the time we've been working on this podcast, another beautiful May in Washington, D.C. came and went. And we couldn't help thinking of someone we spoke to earlier, Nelly Gutierrez. When we spoke with Nelly in the days after the sentencing, she told us she was still struggling to find equilibrium. The family had tried to reach her twice while they were being held hostage, and she didn't realize anything was wrong until it was too late. For nearly a year after the murders, she said, she couldn't work. She struggled with depression, nightmares, insomnia, and guilt.
Sometimes I think, why me? I mean, because I know he killed the family, and physically I'm still alive. He never killed me, but emotionally I died May 14th. Because I tried so hard to move on, but I have Emmy in my mind every day. Every time when I do something, I have all of them. It's not one day that I can forget about. Mm. And especially because I do the same type of job, like cleaning, and so everything is like a memory.
For a while, Nelly put her cleaning business on hold. Eventually, she had to go back to work to earn a living. But returning to work meant going back to Woodland Drive, where she had other clients.
In the first couple months when they killed them, I used to go over there on Tuesday and park my car in front of the house. And I parked in there and I stepped back. But I remember when Detective Owen came to my house, he told me, this is going to happen to you. You're going to be in a lot of stress. You're going to feel guilty because, you know, when something like that happened, you're always going to think, oh, what if? And that was true.
She has ways of coping and ways of remembering her friends, like mementos. She keeps the funeral card from the service for Amy, Sava, and Philip in a glass display case just inside her house, alongside dried flowers and photos of her family. And she has other mementos, too. A few weeks before the murders, Nellie was helping Amy with some spring cleaning at the house. They were sorting through Amy's closet, deciding what to keep and what to donate. Amy came across a formal black dress that no longer fit her, and Nellie remarked on how beautiful it was. Nellie says that Amy insisted she keep the dress, telling her, you never know when you might need it for a funeral. A few weeks later, Nellie wore that dress to bid Amy, Philip, and Sava goodbye. And to say goodbye to Vera. There was a memorial service here in D.C. for Vera shortly after the murders. The Savopoulos family paid to fly her body back to El Salvador to her final resting place. Nellie said she's remained close with Vera's two grown children, her daughter Vera, who's named after her mother, and her son, Ulysses. They exchange text messages and talk on the phone sometimes. Nellie says Vera sounds just like her mother.
I talk to them. Their life is not the same either. Some, you know, like last time they went to the cemetery and they sent me a picture. And we start crying together.
In the fall of 2018, Vera's children came to D.C. to visit Nellie. It was their first time in Washington. Nellie showed them the city and all the places that would give them a feeling for their mom's life here. Nellie says she took them to lunch at Cactus Cantina, a Tex-Mex place a few blocks from the Savopoulos house, where she and Vera used to go sometimes after work for a glass of wine. She says Vera's children were so desperate to see anything that had a connection with their mom. Nellie even took them to the metro station, where Vera would trudge up the steps each day to work.
We have lunch in the restaurant that Vera and I used to drink wine. And we laugh and we cry. And then I took them to the house. And it was so sad, very sad. Because, you know, they said that they still waiting for Mom on Christmas time. Because that was the time that she used to go over there and spend time with them. So it's not easy.
When they came to visit, the house had already been torn down. On the empty lot, tucked away in this magical neighborhood carved out of the woods, the space looked just like a little meadow behind a massive chain-link fence. Visiting it is always emotional for Nellie.
I have a very good memory from them, but I still not well enough. You know. It's
Do you think you're ever going to be able to?
For me, I'm never going to be the same. Because how? It's haunting me almost every day, really they're gone.
There's one more memento Nellie holds on to, and it has to do with the house. After the murders, she found herself driving by the Savopoulos' home on one of the days the bulldozers were tearing it down. She saw the crews knocking down the walls of the brick house, walls that had stood for nearly a century, that had once held a family's joy, birthday parties, piano lessons, and huge meals for Greek Easter. All of that, now just a pile of debris. It was a beautiful spring day, not unlike the day in 2015 when everything changed. Nellie pulled over and got out of her car. She ran up to the pile of rubble and rescued a single brick. This podcast was written, edited, and produced by Jack Moore and me, Megan Cloherty. Julia Ziegler is our content advisor. This is the last regular episode. Next week, we'll be answering some of your questions. If you like 22 Hours, An American Nightmare, rate us on Apple Podcasts. It helps other listeners find this podcast. And head to 22hourspodcast.com to sign up for emails if you want to be alerted to any updates in this case. And to see our video with Nellie, sharing more of her memories. Music for this episode is Haters Hate by Ramon Messam, Beyond the Lows by The Whole Other, and Spookster by Wayne Jones, available in the YouTube audio library. Rhythmic Pulse and Closing My Eyes for a Moment by Daniel Birch and Harbor by Kai Engel are licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0 International. 22 Hours, An American Nightmare is a production of WTOP in Washington, D.C.